All righty, now. We're going to go back to Otto Skorzeny, head of the Odessa, and his work as the sort of head of a group of Nazi war criminals going to work for CIA and the Galen Organization. Now, one of the things that, one of the names that came up in the course of the section that Nip read you from the Infield book on Skorzeny was a fellow by the name of Hermann Lauterbacher. He was one of the XSS men that Skorzeny was recruiting for the CIA while using his CIA recruitment efforts as a device to also build the Odessa. Now, one of the most outrageous uses of Nazi war criminals by the Galen Organization concerned the Galen Organization's use of a bunch of final solution veterans, that is to say, veterans of Hitler's so-called final solution to the Jewish problem, to basically help build first the Egyptian and then later, as we're going to see, the Libyan intelligence service for work against Israel. I'm going to read you an account now about that from the Cookridge book, Galen Spy of the Century. Next, Nasser asked Roosevelt, that's a CIA agent named Kim Roosevelt here, beginning again. Next, Nasser asked Roosevelt to help him reorganize Egypt's military intelligence and secret service in order to buttress his personal power. Political considerations meant that official employment of U.S. officers and CIA agents by the Egyptian government was out of the question, however. Thus, it came about that Dulles approached Galen for assistance. At that time, Galen was absorbed in his struggle with Vollweber, who had taken charge of the East German Ministry for State Security after the Berlin Uprising. Nevertheless, he obliged his friend Dulles by recruiting a military mission of former officers of Hitler's army and the SS. This mission was dispatched to Egypt under ex-Waffen-SS General Wilhelm Farnbacher. In time, it grew to 200 officers. Besides the military mission, however, Nasser needed men to organize his secret service, directing espionage and training saboteurs against Israel, and also to advise on the surveillance of his many enemies inside Egypt, such as the powerful Muslim Brotherhood. Again, his American advisors turned to Galen, asking him to recommend someone qualified to take on the task. During the secret negotiations which followed, Galen thought at one stage of sending one of his own experts from Pulak. He had several men who had conducted espionage against the British during the war in Libya, Egypt, and Iran, but he could not realistically spare one of sufficiently high rank to impress Nasser. He therefore suggested his old colleague, ex-SS Sturmbannführer Otto Skorzeny of Zeppelin fame, to take on the assignment in Egypt. After the war, Skorzeny had spent 3 years in American captivity in Germany as a suspected war criminal. He had been released in July of 1948 and was living in Spain, where he had established a prosperous engineering business. He was reluctant to accept. For one thing, the Egyptians offered little financial inducement. He was promised that CIA would top up his salary from Nasser. Dulles and Galen also approached Skorzeny's father-in-law, Dr. Hjalmar Schacht, once Hitler's financial wizard, who, after his acquittal at Nuremberg and the quashing of his 8 years sentence under the denazification laws, had become president of a bank in Dusseldorf. So besieged from so many sides, Herr Skorzeny graciously agreed on the condition that his stay in Cairo should be limited. Skorzeny worked in Egypt for about a year, and then left Nasser's secret service in the good hands of other SS and Gestapo men. He had recruited about 50, of whom some had to be summoned from Argentina, Brazil, Paraguay, and Spain, where they had found a safe haven from Allied prosecution as war criminals. Among his assistants was a high official of Goebbels' propaganda ministry and Himmler's RSHA, Franz Bünsch, last name B-U-E-N-S-C-H, an expert on Jewish matters. He had worked with Eichmann on the final solution during the war and had written a book entitled Sexual Habits of the Jews, which was probably the most viciously pornographic document ever produced by the Nazis. These German intelligencers in Cairo looked to Galen for advice, and he appointed a liaison officer to them whom he sent from Germany. He was a bird of the same feather as they, an ex-SS officer and deputy Reich leader of the Hitler Youth, Hermann Lauterbacher. Recall, that's the same Hermann Lauterbacher that we were talking about just a few minutes ago, whom Skorzeny was first recruiting in Europe for work for CIA. There are indications here, a little later in this passage, that Galen's habit of recruiting SS men, and specifically war criminals that had been employed by Hitler in the final solution, that this practice continued even after Galen, along with his organization, made the jump to West Germany as the BND. And indeed, we find a very prominent war criminal working for BND in Syria. Cookridge writes, at Damascus, the BND resident was ex-SS Hauptsturmfuhrer Alois Brunner, alias George Fischer, who posed as the director of the German-Syrian trading company Otraco. Brunner later joined Bunch in Cairo. They were old colleagues, for they had both worked under Eichmann at the RSHA Jewish Department.
Okay, continuing on, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that this section here is also from Skorzeny, Hitler's Commando by Glenn Infield. This section goes into a little more detail, and another name of a rather significant individual comes up, just sort of cementing another plank in the platform, to mix a metaphor, of the kinds of things that the United States was indirectly sponsoring through its use of these former SS officers to help put together and staff and train the Egyptian Secret Service. The author here is referring at first to Skorzeny, and he says as follows. His first task was to organize a staff of former SS and Wehrmacht officers to train the Egyptian army and security forces. He selected carefully, making certain that each officer he brought to Egypt was a die-hard Nazi, an expert military tactician, and was anti-Semitic. Among those recruited by Skorzeny were SS General Oskar Derlewanger, who had commanded a brigade composed of poachers, criminals, and men under the sentence of court-martial during the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, and whose actions against the Jews had earned him the nickname Butcher of Warsaw. SS Colonel Adolf Eichmann, the officer Himmler charged with the destruction of millions of Jews and who later would be kidnapped from Argentina by the Israeli Secret Service and smuggled back to Israel to stand trial. SS General Wilhelm Farnbacher, Panzer General Oskar Munzel, Leopold Gleim, former chief of Hitler's personal guard and Gestapo security chief of German-occupied Poland, and Joachim Demling, former chief of the Gestapo in Dusseldorf. To handle medical problems, Skorzeny recruited Dr. Hans Eisele, who had been chief medical officer at Buchenwald concentration camp, and Heinrich Willermann, former medical director at Dachau. Okay. Now, this is, again, as mentioned before, an example of the kind of continuity. Remember, we talked at the top of the show about continuity and the existence of structures and the basic whole importation of these structures directly out of Nazi Germany into the American intelligence service field, and then later there they wind up in Egypt putting together the Secret Service there only 6 or 7 years after the war is over.
Now, notice not only do Bunch and Alois Brunner wind up in the Middle East, but Adolf Eichmann himself, the fellow who is, at least according to this account by Infield, Adolf Eichmann himself, and it's worth noting that Infield was, I drew this material from an interview with Skorzeny, the fellow who led this mission, so Eichmann himself went to work, I guess, in essence, as a CIA contract agent in putting together this contingent of Final Solution veterans to work for the Egyptian Secret Service. Now, in Skorzeny, Infield also adds another interesting detail of the work that Skorzeny did while in Egypt, putting together this group of war criminals to, in essence, form the Egyptian Secret Service and State Security Service. Infield writes, Skorzeny was already training an Arab Foreign Legion in commando tactics. This secret unit was comprised of 400 former Nazis and Gestapo veterans and used a training base at Bilbaeus in the Delta, that of course being the Nile Delta. He also helped organize and train the first Palestine terrorists and planned their initial forays into Israel by way of the Gaza Strip about 1953-54. So while in the Middle East under CIA auspices, Skorzeny also puts together the first Palestinian terrorists, and of course we've heard so much about them in the intervening years.
Now, and again, an important thing to bear in mind is that specifically the United States handed this assignment over to the Galen operation. Galen handed it over to Skorzeny, and Skorzeny specifically selected these people, among other things, because of their staunch anti-Semitism, because, of course, of the situation between Egypt and Israel. So, in fact, the United States, at second hand, was specifically sending anti-Semites to train the Egyptian Secret Service, and of course the character of much of the Egyptian government at that time was strongly anti-Semitic. The health minister talked about Adolf Hitler being more or less his main man and one of his heroes and things of that nature, and a very, very strong emphasis of that kind. So when you hear about the beginnings of the PLO, or at least of a PLO at that time, Palestinian terrorist organizations anyway, One has to wonder, once again, if maybe we're not, in fact, reaping our own harvest in the Middle East.
Okay, now, research credit for this next article here goes to Mae Brussel, who is America's premier anti-fascist and assassination researcher, and in a certain sense could be said to be sort of the godmother of this whole Radio Free America series. She turned both Nip Tuck and myself onto the vast majority of the books that we've used in this series, and she specifically dug up this following piece of information for us. This comes from a book called Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. This, like many of the books about Third Reich alumni, specifically chronicles the post-war activities of, among others, Martin Bormann, who, although sort of, I guess you could call pop histories of the Third Reich list him as having died, his escape and post-war activities are, in fact, very, very well documented. And Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, was authored by a former CBS correspondent and colleague of Edward R. Murrow named Paul Manning, M-A-N-N-I-N-G. Book was published in hardcover and copyrighted 1981, published by Lyle Stewart Books. And this, recall that Scorzani's work, as reported by Glenn Infield, also involved training the first Palestinian terrorists to go into Israel, and another name which has become very much identified with modern terrorism, also touched base with these Nazi war criminals that were put together by CIA, sent to Egypt under Scorzani, in effect became sort of a little, as he put it, an Arab foreign legion, basically a little Final Solution contingent in the Middle East. Manning writes as follows. Colonel Gaddafi of Libya, then the new revolutionary leader of his country, asked Nasser to make the German team of advisors available to him also. This was done. And upon arrival, the Germans started with a thorough house cleaning of the Libyan secret service hired by the previous ruler, King Idris. 2,000 Libyan police were put in jail and continue to languish there today, and the Germans rebuilt from scratch. Today, Libyan intelligence agents are stationed in all Libyan, African, and overseas embassies and consulates, and they are tough and ruthless. Perhaps as a quid pro quo to this service to Libya, the colonel granted the West German rocket company Otrag rights to a vast test range 600 miles south of Tripoli in 1980. So not only is the Egyptian secret service put together by these Nazi war criminals, but the Libyan intelligence service as well. And this little passage here where he notes overseas embassies are staffed with these efficient and ruthless Libyan intelligence agencies has considerable meaning for us here in the spring and early summer of 1984.
Indeed, most of you out there will remember, of course, the incident that actually led to the breaking off of diplomatic relations between Libya and Great Britain, when in fact some unnamed person who was never apprehended because he was allowed to leave the country shot an English policewoman to death and wounded several anti-Gaddafi demonstrators in London in front of the Libyan embassy. Also, on the subject of Gaddafi, now, Muammar Gaddafi is going to appear at great length in a later Radio Free America, probably in August, tangent with his, one hesitates to say good buddies, but certainly his associates, Ed Wilson, Frank Turpel, and Gary Corkula, all supposedly ex-CIA agents of doubtful pedigree, and all interesting in a variety of ways. But once again, Gaddafi shows up quite interestingly, especially in this context, because again and again we have been told that Gaddafi is a pro-Soviet, you know, leftist supporter of terrorism. In fact, as we've noted in other broadcasts here on KFJC, Gaddafi is a participant with Otto Skorzeny in groups like the Paladin Group, which are actually members of the Internationale Fascista, and we have these connections here, his direct connections early on to Skorzeny, and essentially importing the Nazi Final Solution experts right into his country to train his own secret service, which, as almost anybody can tell you, is probably the only thing keeping the man in power at this point in Libya, because he is certainly not a very popular ruler. Anyway, on the subject, though, since we're not going to go into it too deeply tonight, on the subject of Turpel and Wilson and others, a local writer by the name of Pete Carey, working for the San Jose Mercury, was in fact, as we'll explain more after we read this article, was doing some research on those self-same folks, most notably Frank Turpel and his rather interesting series of connections to various political events. In the course of his research, and again, that also we'll explain a little more in a moment, he came across a rather interesting individual that should hopefully hammer home to those of you who are not familiar with his material how local and how quickly local some of this stuff can get.
Now, keep in mind that Frank Turpel and Edwin Wilson, quote, ex unquote, CIA agents were instrumental in arming and training Gaddafi's Secret Service as well, and his terrorist organizations, which have received so much publicity. And Frank Turpel was actually affiliated with another Galen veteran and another Final Solution veteran, another Eichmann, this is not a subordinate, but an Eichmann superior within the SS and the SD, the Sicherheitsdienst, the SS Intelligence Service, and this is a fellow Nip's going to tell you about right now.
Indeed. The gentleman in question, and I use the term gentleman very loosely, as people have noted who have listened to our broadcast before, was a man by the name of Otto von Bolsping. Again, note, not only was this man high-ranking SS and SD man, but in fact spent his last years right here in the Bay Area with numerous connections in the Silicon Valley business world. Okay, this article that we're going to be reading from comes from the San Jose Mercury for November 20th, 1981. Again, the article was put together by Pete Carey in the course of what was originally an investigation into Frank Turpel and others. And the article is headlined, Ex-Nazi's Brilliant U.S. Career Strangled in a Web of Lies. For the past 10 years, Otto Albrecht Alfred von Bolsching's carefully constructed life in America has been coming apart a piece at a time. He was president of a high-technology investment firm with headquarters in Sacramento and subsidiaries in the Silicon Valley. It went bankrupt in a 1971 scandal. He was a doting husband until his ailing wife killed herself in 1978. He numbered among his business associates millionaires, bankers, and scientists. Then his brain stem was hit by a rare disease 2 years ago, sending him into isolation at a Carmichael rest home. He told friends he had worked for the Americans during and after World War II. But in May, the federal government began proceedings to deport him for lying about his Nazi past. And I should just mention in passing here that Otto von Bolsping did die a couple of months after this article was written. In a widely publicized attempt to revoke von Bolsping's citizenship, the Justice Department accused him of helping Hitler's persecution of European Jews and of being an associate of Adolf Eichmann, the architect of Germany's mass killing program. The disclosures come at the end of a long, improbable career that took von Bolsching through the Nazi hierarchy, into the CIA, and finally to the highest levels of American business. The list of people he knew, some of whom he met through a California high-technology business venture in 1970, reads like a who's who. They include Justice William A. Newsom of the First District Court of Appeals in San Francisco, Helene von Dahm, President Reagan's personal secretary, Thomas, we'll talk about her more later, by the way, Thomas A. Franzioli, banker to the Boston Cabot family, Emmanuel Thanakis, Fairchild Corporation Senior Vice President, Elmer Bobst, President of Warner Lambert Pharmaceutical Company, and Alfred Driscoll, former New Jersey Governor and Warner Lambert's Chairman. Quote, I'm nonplussed, Justice Newsom had said. Justice Newsom said, I thought, if anything, Otto had been pro-American during the war. As a businessman, von Bolsping was vague about the war years. He said he had been a Gestapo prisoner and had worked for the CIA in post-war Germany. In 1969, he was asked about his German past during a job interview with Trans International Computer Investment Corporation, a high-flying investment firm that had founded several companies in the Silicon Valley. Von Bolsping told his interviewer he had been a lawyer. Quote, during what years was that, he was asked, according to a transcript of the interview. Quote, until I was thrown in the Gestapo prison in 1942, von Bolsping responded. That was not a good experience. One should forget it, because it only is a negative approach to life to think about bad things. After a moment's reflection, he added, quote, I think it would be better to speak about recent times than God knows how many years ago. Who was this ex-Nazi, and how did he prosper in America? Von Bolsping's attorney would not allow an interview. This account was developed from people who knew him, accounts of Nazi Germany, court records, and business files. Born October 15, 1909, to East Prussian nobility, the family estate was founded in 1302, von Bolsping attended school in Breslau, and became a Nazi Party member at the age of 24, the only member of his family to do so. He joined the SS, the elite secret police of the Nazis, 6 years later. According to the Justice Department, as an SS captain, he helped plan the exclusion of Jews from the German economy and developed anti-Jewish propaganda to force their emigration from Germany. In A History of the SS by Heinz Herne, von Bolschwing is described as, quote, a party member, an SD, foreign intelligence informer, and an experienced salesman in the motor trade. In 1938, quote, he was in contact with a group of Palestinian Germans who lined their pockets by certain extramural intelligence activities, according to Herne, who wrote that von Bolschwing spied on the Zionist Haganah Army. Ejected from Palestine by the British for espionage, he surfaced in Romania as a government, quote, oil expert. By his own account, in 1941, he helped the leadership of the Iron Guard, a right-wing movement, escape to Berlin after it had gone on a three-day rampage in which many Jews, the estimates vary considerably, were brutally killed.
Of course, that pogrom there was led by Valerian Trieffe, the fellow who we talked about in the second Radio Free America broadcast and who broadcast for Radio Free Europe, went to work for Galen after the war.
Indeed. The same year, he became partner in an Amsterdam bank. The Bank voor Onroerende Zaken. Investigators said they suspect the bank may have played a role in the, quote, Aryanization, the forced sale of Dutch Jewish farms, businesses, homes, and securities. In August 1941, von Bolschwing was tossed into a Gestapo prison with no formal charges. And in April 1942, he was just as mysteriously released. In 1945, he helped American troops entering Austria catch Nazi officials and SS officers, according to a letter written for von Bolschwing by a colonel in the 71st U.S. Infantry. The war over, von Bolschwing made a move crucial to his future success. He became an American spy. Quote, he knocked on the door of U.S. Army intelligence, a source explained, and said, I'm experienced. I have a ring operating. If you give me a paycheck, I'll make you very happy. He was sort of a miniature Reinhard Galen.
Galen was the Nazi general who helped the CIA build a spy network in post-war Eastern Europe, then became head of post-war German intelligence activities. According to one unconfirmed report, von Bolschwing became the controller of Galen's CIA operation after Galen returned to German government. He must have done something right, the source said. In December of 1953, von Bolschwing applied to immigrate to the United States, and on February 2nd, 1954, he arrived in this country. After obtaining several menial jobs, he became a citizen in 1959, and his career took a sudden upward turn. He became an assistant to the director of international marketing at Warner Lambert Pharmaceutical Company, developing close ties to the company's president, and the late Elmer Bobst, and its honorary board chairman, former New Jersey Governor Alfred Driscoll, according to a close associate. His contacts at Warner Lambert were way out of proportion with his job, the associate said. Driscoll continued to write him recommendations for many years, unquote. By the mid-1960s, von Bolschwing had become an executive with Cabot Manufacturing. As chief financial officer for its German subsidiary, he developed a $50 million carbon black factory for Cabot in Germany. The deal was financed through Thomas Franzioli, senior vice president of the First National Bank of Boston. Franzioli recalls that von Bolschwing then branched out on his own. He was starting a business importing wine from Argentina, Franzioli recalled. I don't know if it ever got off the ground. In March of 1969, von Bolschwing got a job in high technology. He was retained as an international business consultant by TCI, the Sacramento firm. The company planned to commercialize on technology developed in the Silicon Valley and used a few years earlier to monitor troop movements in the 1967 Arab-Israeli War, according to the firm's founder, Oswald S. Williams. TCI's subsidiaries in Palo Alto and Mountain View, Advanced Information Systems and International Imaging Systems, were developing a high-volume computer network for business and a navigation system for oil tankers using satellite communications, Williams said. The company also did classified work for the Department of Defense. Ours was going to be a sensitive thing, Williams explained. We all had to have security clearances. Von Bolschwing was brought in because, quote, we wanted contacts in Europe, and he had them, Williams said. A TCI memo written in 1969 reported that its new consultant, quote, has extremely valuable connections and information in Germany, Switzerland, Liechtenstein, the Netherlands, Antilles, and South America. Mr. von Bolschwing's connections in these countries are current, unquote. His contacts included officials of the German branch of Chase Manhattan Bank and an owner of the Berliner Handelsgesellschaft in Frankfurt, one of Europe's largest banks, the memo said. TCI's high-powered directors, one was J. Paul Getty, Jr., son of the oil billionaire, thought enough of von Bolschwing to make him the firm's president in 1970. He seemed like a very polite and cultured person, said Walter F. Leverton, former vice president for satellite systems of the Aerospace Corporation. Leverton sat on the board of TCI. Justice Newsom, who traveled as a TCI attorney with von Bolschwing in Europe in 1969-70, said von Bolschwing alluded to wartime work for the Americans. He was suave and plausible, Newsom said. He seemed to have all the credentials. He looked kind of world-weary, recalled Newsom. He had the long cigarette holder, his hair was slicked back. Emmanuel Fanakis, who had resigned as an international telephone and telegraph vice presidency to sign on with TCI, also traveled with von Bolschwing in Europe, meeting his banking and industry contacts. Otto was very pleasant and soft, Fanakis said. He talked about his past of working for intelligence. I don't know if it was the CIA or what, but after the war, he helped the United States and the Allies to find Nazis. Records and interviews with TCI officials indicate that Helena von Damm, President Reagan's Austrian-born deputy assistant, translated some German contracts for TCI and invested $1,000 in it while she was then Governor Reagan's secretary in Sacramento. Von Damm was too busy, unquote, to talk about von Bolschwing, but through her White House secretary said she knew him socially in Sacramento many years ago. Justice Department investigators had stumbled across the name of Otto von Bolschwing in 1979 while working on the case of Valerian Trifa, a leader of the Iron Guard's anti-Jewish rampage in Romania. Investigators had found Trifa in Detroit, and in investigating him, they interviewed von Bolschwing. He admitted helping Trifa and other Iron Guard members escape Romania after the 1941 pogrom. But in a sworn statement, he denied ever having been a member of the SS, the SD, or the Nazi Party. Well, that is certainly quite a bit to contemplate there. All of the big names that von Bolschwing touches bases with. First of all, take note of the report that he was head of Galen's North American operation after Galen jumped back to West Germany as head of the BND. Some of the names here that are worth noting. This Governor Alfred Driscoll, affiliated former chairman of the board of Warner Lambert Pharmaceuticals. Albert Driscoll was the man who placed Richard Nixon's name into nomination at the 1968 Republican convention. And, of course, keep in mind the Trifa-Nixon connection that we've talked about in the past. And another thing that's worth noting here are the many connections between von Bolschwing and some of the same industrial operations which we talked about in connection with the American Nazi industrial axis, which had a great deal to do with building Nazi industrial power. Note IT&T here. One of its vice presidents, Emmanuel Fanakis, went to work for TCI, traveled with von Bolschwing. As we mentioned in our Uncle Sam and the Swastika broadcast, an ITT subsidiary, the Lorenz Company, manufactured the Focke-Wulf aircraft for Nazi Germany, and ITT also built a lot of electrical parts for Nazi Germany as well. You'll recall in the section about Radio Free Europe, both the Ford and Standard Oil financial empires were involved with financing Radio Free Europe and the Galen contingent within that. And, of course, also we've seen that von Bolschwing had contact with the Chase Manhattan Bank. And Chase Manhattan, as we have looked at in the past, Chase Manhattan was involved with freezing the accounts of Jewish investors in its Paris branch even before the Third Reich requested such a freezing, and they worked very, very closely with the Third Reich. And of course, in this whole interview here, this whole article, I should say, perhaps the name that jumps out the most is that of Helena von Damm. And this article identifies her as President Reagan's Austrian-born deputy assistant. She basically was responsible for drawing up the list from which all of Reagan's cabinet appointees were named, and were made, I should say. And note that von Bolschwing, who certainly spoke German himself, picked her, of all people, to do translating for these documents for TCI. Noted that she also invested in TCI while then Governor Reagan's secretary. Now, the Fondam von Bolschwing connection is one that certainly bears investigating and bears, having more light shed on it. As we like to say in these broadcasts, food for thought, grounds for further research, because Helena Fondam has certainly not been idle, and her connections to a high-ranking Nazi war criminal. Now, keep in mind that von Bolschwing was Eichmann's superior. Von Bolschwing, among other things, was arranging for cooperation between the SS and the Haganah during World War II, and as that Hoene passage indicated. And the Fondam-von Bolschwing connection here certainly bears a lot of scrutiny, just as the Treva-Nixon connection did.
Among other things that that bear scrutiny is the rise that Helena Fondam has made within the Reagan administration. Let me just real quickly read an article, and then I'm going to add something to it. This article is from the San Francisco Chronicle for Tuesday, August 3rd, 1982. The article is headlined, Big Promotion for Reagan's Ex-Secretary. Now, let me just say one thing, just that I thought it was kind of amusing as I was reading through this very, very short little blip here, is they talk the article headlines, and I'm sure it was, it says, Big Promotion. See if you can tell the difference from this article between what she was doing and what she was promoted to. Once again, Big Promotion for Reagan's Ex-Secretary from the Chronicle, August of 82. President Reagan announced yesterday in Des Moines that he will promote Helena Fondam to the position of Assistant to the President for Presidential Personnel. She will replace E. Pendleton James, who is returning to the private sector, according to the White House announcement. Fondam, formerly Reagan's secretary, has worked with him since his first campaign for governor of California in 1966. She is now Deputy Assistant to the President and Director of Presidential Personnel. Okay, let me just give you those two titles again, just because it's rather interesting. She is being promoted to the position of Assistant to the President for Presidential Personnel. This is a big promotion from her current position as Deputy Assistant to the President and Director of Presidential Personnel. You figure out what that means. Anyway, one of the things significant, of course, is that Helena Fondam's position did put her in an area where she could influence selectees or possible selectees for government positions. However, since then, Helena Fondam's fortunes have risen yet again. She is currently, as last heard, the American ambassador to Austria. So she has risen from being Ronald Reagan's personal secretary to now being the ambassador from the United States to Austria. So a fairly significant rise. Once again, as Dave says, food for thought and grounds for further research, something to be looked into, and certainly the matter of going over to translate German contracts for a corporation with a German president, and instead of being paid for it, apparently giving them $1,000 to invest, while she was at the same time President Reagan's secretary, or at that time Governor Reagan's secretary. Anyway, kind of a weird story, but once again, just something to note, the proximity, the geographical proximity of some of these affairs. We have probably the North American chief of the Galen organization actually living and working out of the Bay Area, right here where we sit.
Okay, now keep in mind also that von Bolschwing, basically Pete Carey came across von Bolschwing while following the trail of Frank Turpel, who his ex-CIA status is very doubtful, as we'll talk about in the program that we do on the Turpel-Wilson connection. And keep in mind that Gaddafi's Secret Service put together by the Galen contingent of Nazi war criminals we talked about before. And again, the Turpel von Bolschwing connection and the Gaddafi-Galen connection is a very interesting one for our purposes here. Well, the question, of course, remains, what kind of a person was Reinhard Galen? I mean, he had such a massive role upon World War II history, post-World War II history, that the question must remain, must be asked here, you know, what kind of a person was the aforementioned Reinhard Galen? Now, I guess in a book we're going to talk about here in just a second, a book called The Borman Brotherhood, the author says that the glimpse of mass killers that we've seen gives us a clue as to the character of their employer. Well, we're going to go into specifically an interview that this very same man, a man named William Stevenson, had with Reinhard Galen. Now, we're going to be talking about a book we're going to be reading from now, I should say, a book called, as I said, The Borman Brotherhood. This was authored by a man named William Stevenson, a former British intelligence agent, not to be confused with the William Stevenson of intrepid fame. His name is spelled S-T-E-P-H-E-N-S-O-N. This William Stevenson is S-T-E-V-E-N-S-O-N. Same name, both former British intelligence agents, but of a very different mindset, so don't confuse them. Borman Brotherhood was published in soft cover in 1974, copyrighted 1974, by Bantam Books. And William Stevenson was one of the very few print journalists ever granted a lengthy interview with Reinhard Galen. And in the Borman Brotherhood, he describes Galen as follows. Speaking of Galen, he had been described as, quote, ruthless in his determination to recreate the German Reich by Major Hermann Baun. At one time, Baun was regarded as the best Russian expert within German military intelligence. Baun was got rid of, dying so miserably that much hostility was created against Galen, even among those who shared his nationalist ambitions. One reason for Baun's elimination was that in 1946, he had cooperated a little too closely with the British Secret Service for his own good. He had described the plans made during the war for escape, and his report linked Galen with such prominent figures as Otto Skorzeny. Still later, in talking about a very famous Nazi hunter named Beata Klarsfeld, Galen speaks as follows here to William Stevenson. Beata Klarsfeld plays the communist game, Galen told me. Is it true she married a Jew? His secretary, Anna Laura Allo Kruger, inclined her head. Doubtless that explains it, Galen said. And on about a page later, as an interesting insight here by William Stevenson. The face seemed familiar, a face I realized later, astonishingly like that of Hitler. The feeling grew when I talked with him later. A small man with curious pointed ears, slow-moving blue eyes, and a neat little mustache.
Indeed, a very familiar description. One of the things that is going to be in this next section, continuing with the interview and Stevenson's impressions of the interview, is going to be a mention of a man named Frick, F-R-I-C-K. We would say Frick. It's Frick. Believe the first name is Wilhelm. Frick owned the house that Galen set up in. Frick himself was not around to own that property anymore because Frick had been shot for, among other things, at the end of the war, because of the fact that he had been the person who signed the law for the protection of German blood, one of the profoundest and strongest measures that was part of the impetus leading up to the final solution. Now, one of the interesting little sidelights of the fate of Frick, so to speak, is the fact that the gentleman, again in the term used loosely, who designed those laws for the preservation of German blood, a man by the name of Hans Glubke, who we talked about at some length last Radio Free America broadcast, in fact not only was not shot as the man who signed it was, but in fact went on to become the most powerful man in post-World War II Germany as special assistant to Chancellor Konrad Adenauer, and in fact was the man who everything had to go through to get to Adenauer, and in fact was also the person who was himself ultimately responsible in the chancellery for the Galen organization. So that's Glubke, the man who made up the laws for preservation of the German blood, winds up becoming the most powerful man in the chancellery. The man who signed them is shot, and Reinhard Galen later goes on to inhabit his property, and that's where this interview is taking place. And that's why Stevenson is thinking about it. From Stevenson's book, The Borman Brotherhood, speaking of Reinhard Galen, he writes, he, Galen, saw himself as the guardian of Germany's traditional institutions. He felt responsible for rescuing the only Nazi German organization and maintaining continuity almost unbroken from becoming head of Foreign Armies East to chief of the Galen organization aimed at Russia. I'm going to reread that because that echoes so closely from Galen's own mouth what Carl Oglesby was saying that when we led the broadcast off with his selection. Galen saw himself as the guardian of Germany's traditional institutions. He felt responsible for rescuing the only Nazi German organization and maintaining continuity almost unbroken, from becoming head of Hitler's Foreign Armies East to chief of the Galen organization aimed at Russia. He quoted a politician of 50 years ago who had said, quote, "Germany and Japan are the natural opponents of any Russian expansion, but the British Empire and the United States in the long run are the most threatened," unquote. Now there, said Gray Fox, a nickname for Galen, was true perception. If a man could see historical trends half a century ahead, how much more effectively this could be done with modern methods of analysis. Absolute freedom of the press was dangerous. There must be ways of screening officialdom from public scrutiny. "My eyelids began to droop," says Stevenson. "Freak" must have sounded like this. If the war had turned out differently, Reinhard Galen's name would have been inscribed in the thousand-year Reich's Hall of Fame. His words showed no change of heart. SS men were put at the disposal of the Egyptian government, quote, "to inject expertise into the Egyptian secret service." He still betrayed indignation at the way the British during the war, quote, "pumped out propaganda against us through the BBC.